On a Tuesday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. If you were feeling bleary-eyed when your alarm went off or when you started hearing our voices this morning, there's a good chance you're not finely attuned to your body's own sleep cues. A new study by German sleep researchers finds that in our 24/7 culture, many of us are paying the price for ignoring our internal biological clocks. And as NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the consequences can be measured in our expanding waistlines.
We all know what jet lag is. You fly across time zones, your internal clock gets confused, and all you want to do is eat and sleep at all the wrong times. But think about this. What if the pace and schedule of our everyday lives is leading to the same sort of effect? This is the theory of German sleep researcher Till Ronneberg.
The idea came from sleep logs. We've got hundreds of sleep logs or even thousands of sleep logs.
Ronneberg says when he analyzed people's sleep and wake times, some interesting patterns emerged. People's schedules during the work week were so different from their routines on the weekend that it was as if they had switched time zones. For example, waking up very early Monday to Thursday and more or less going to bed at a regular time. Then on Friday, still waking up early, but staying up or staying out with friends until the wee hours of Saturday morning.
What these look like if the people would fly on a Friday evening many time zones to the west.
So Saturday morning, you wake up 3 to 4 hours later than usual, you eat later, maybe brunch at noon instead of breakfast at 7, and you live by a different clock the whole weekend.
We realized that this was a jet lag-like situation.
He's coined the phrase social jet lag, where sleep isn't governed by your biological clock, but by your social calendar. I tried out the theory on a group of 20-something professionals who were hanging out together here in Washington, D.C.
That definitely applies to my life.
Friends Katie Gambale and Amanda Zoitlin say their weekend schedules are completely different.
Well, we don't have to wake up as early because we don't have work, so we'll go out even later and then sleep really late.
Katie Gambale says it does seem a little crazy.
So we were actually just discussing this. A lot of the social norms right now involve like going out at a really late hour. And nobody actually goes out until 11 or 12 at night, which I think is bizarre. But if you don't do it, you're not going to be out when your friends are out. So it's kind of the culture now to be a night owl.
For now, this schedule works. This gang of friends is fit and vivacious and say they feel they get enough sleep. But Ronneberg says in the long term, living against our biological clocks can catch up with us.
People who suffer from social jet lag hardly ever sleep one night that is according to their sleep need.
And Ronneberg's research finds that this social jet lag is linked to higher body weight.
The larger the discrepancy between the social time and what your biological clock tells you to do, the more likely it is that you are obese.
Whether disrupting your body clock has an effect on your weight over and above the fact it reduces the amount of sleep you get is unclear, but there's certainly a whole body of evidence linking too little sleep to weight problems.
As sleep researchers, we do believe that there's an intimate relationship between insufficient sleep and the drive to store fat.
Physician Helene M. Selim directs the Center for Sleep and Wake Disorders in Chevy Chase, Maryland. She says this connection has been documented in shift workers, such as nurses, in teenagers, and in mothers of infants. In some cases, people do eat more when their schedules are wacky. But M. Selim says it's also possible that something more primitive is at play here.
Unfortunately, we have caveman's hardcore wiring, and insufficient sleep in primitive times was read by the body as danger, store fat.
Which was our ancestors' best chance of surviving whatever calamity was keeping them awake. And when this happens, it seems a hormonal shift takes place, so that instead of burning calories quickly, the body tries to store them. Experts say this may be just one of several complicated mechanisms linking sleep and weight. But Dr. Matthew Gilman of Harvard Medical School, who directs an obesity prevention program, says the important take-home message is this.
We know if people sleep less, even starting in infants, that leads to greater risk of obesity.
Gilman acknowledges that this sleep longer, sleep better message is easier to preach than to live by.
And I guess I'm a big offender because I got up this morning at 4 o'clock to make a 6 o'clock flight to Washington, D.C.
But in our crazy go-go society, it may be wise to start paying more attention to that internal clock. You definitely have one, and it does not sound like this. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The natural gas boom that's underway in the country is creating a lot of excitement. It's providing jobs and injecting cash, often into areas that were hit hard by the economic downturn. It's also providing an abundant and cheap source of energy. But there are a lot of concerns about the impact on health and the environment. All this week, we'll be hearing from people living on the front lines of the gas drilling industry, and we'll look into just how safe it is to live and work so close to this fast-growing sector. Today, NPR's Rob Stein takes us to a health clinic in rural Pennsylvania.
Everything seemed pretty quiet when Kay Allen started work that day. She's a nurse at a community clinic in southwestern Pennsylvania. But things didn't stay quiet for long.
All the girls, they were yelling at me in the back, "You gotta come out here quick, you gotta come out here quick."
Kay rushed out front and knew right away what all the yelling was about. The whole place reeked, like someone had spilled a giant bottle of nail polish remover.
So I told everybody to get outside and get fresh air. So we went outside, and Aggie said, "Kay, I'm gonna be sick," but before I could get in to get something for her to throw up in, she had to go over the railing.
Nothing like this had ever happened in the 20 years Kay's been at the clinic. After about 45 minutes, she thought the coast was clear and took everyone back inside.
It was fine. But then the next thing you know, they're calling me again. There was another gust. Well, the one girl, Miranda, she was sitting at the registration place, and you could tell she had had too much of it. And Miranda got overcome by that, and she passed out.
This sort of thing has been happening for weeks at the Cornerstone Care Clinic in Burkittstown, Pennsylvania. Mysterious gusts of fumes keep wafting through the clinic. The day before our visit, Kay suddenly felt like she'd been engulfed by one of these big invisible bubbles.
And all of a sudden, your tongue gets this metal taste on it, and it feels like it's enlarging, and it just feels like you're not getting enough air in because your throat gets real burny. And the next thing I know, I was...
Yeah. You passed out.
I passed out.
Half a dozen of Kay's co-workers stopped coming in. One old-timer quit. No one can figure out what's going on. For doctors and nurses used to taking care of sick people, it's unnerving to suddenly be the patients.
It's the unknown, I think, that is the scariest thing.
So they're doing what doctors usually do in this kind of situation. Look for the cause. Rich Reinhardt runs Cornerstone. It's surrounded by valleys and rolling green hills. And on one of those hills, he just noticed a tower. That means there's a new gas well there. He can't help but wonder whether the natural gas drilling going on all around them may have something to do with it.
I'm laying in bed at night thinking all kinds of theories. So is something coming through the air from some process that they're using? I know they use a lot of chemicals and so forth. Certainly that could be a culprit. We're wondering, is something coming up through the ground?
Now, no one knows whether the gas drilling has anything to do with what's happening. It could easily turn out to be something completely unrelated. There's a smelting plant down the road, old coal mines everywhere.
Anything could be possible, and we just are trying to get to the root of it.
This mystery isn't just happening at the Cornerstone Clinic. People living near gas well drilling all around the country are reporting similar symptoms, plus terrible headaches, nasty rashes, wheezing, weird aches and pains. And some of the doctors in places where drilling's booming say they don't know how to help these patients. Dr. Julie DeRosa works at Cornerstone.
I don't want to ignore symptoms that could be clues to a serious condition. I also don't want to order a lot of unnecessary tests. I don't want to feed any kind of hysteria.
To try to figure out what's going on, the clinic called in some experts. They called Pennsylvania's version of the EPA, which is investigating. They also started testing the air for chemicals and keeping diaries of everyone's symptoms. And they called Raina Ripple.
Okay, we just wanted to do a couple quick water samples, so...
Ripple just started a nonprofit to help people in southwestern Pennsylvania struggling with this kind of medical mystery. Her team's at the clinic today to take samples of tap water from inside a men's room and from a stream out back.
Just let it run a little bit before you do it.
She knows people in the area have a lot of questions.
Is my water safe to drink? Is the air fit to breathe? Am I going to suffer long-term health impacts from this?
To try to answer these questions, her project's connecting doctors and patients with experts who might be able to help sort things out. These are toxicologists, occupational health doctors, environmental scientists. David Brown helped set up the program because he knows people are frustrated.
People go from physician to physician because nobody seems to be able to treat this awful rash that I have, or nobody seems to be able to deal with my gastrointestinal pain that I have. And so they go from place to place trying to find someone that can do that.
So the project's starting to educate doctors about what kinds of tests they can try and what kind of advice to give. And they also have a nurse practitioner. She visits and counsels people who are sick. Dr. Sian Portman's one of the project's doctors, but Portman's skeptical many people are getting sick from the drilling, which is commonly called fracking. There are 5,000 new wells in Pennsylvania. Given those numbers, he says,
you'd expect people dropping all over the place based on the amount of fracking that's going on here. You would look around and see people dropping like flies. It's not the case. I don't see anybody affected, and it's not for a lack of looking.
Portman, who like a lot of people in the area has leased some of his land for drilling, wants to make sure no one's missing more mundane explanations.
We have an old saying, in medicine you hear hoofbeats, you don't think zebras, you think horses.
The cause could be something a lot more common, Lyme disease, some kind of virus, allergies. The natural gas industry says there's no evidence that drilling is causing health problems. Health experts say there's only really one way to know whether the drilling is making people sick or not. Do some big studies. Christopher Portier heads the National Center for Environmental Health.
There's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there, and so a well-conducted study looking at a number of communities could help us better understand if there's an impact, what's its magnitude, how we should avoid having that impact if there is one.
Problem is, no one's done that yet. So in the meantime, patients and doctors don't have a lot of options. In western Pennsylvania, a lot of them are being referred to Dr. Charles Wernz. He's just across the border in Morgantown at West Virginia University. He's used to dealing with chemical exposures. He usually treats workers who get sick on the job. Lately, he's seeing more people who live near the drilling. For now, he can't really do much more than offer basic advice. Drink bottled water, air out the house, leave your shoes outside. And, Wernz says, if it's still bad, move. If you can.
It is frustrating. As a physician, I like it when somebody can come to me with a problem and I can help them solve the problem, whether it's through, a specific treatment or, whatever. And this is frustrating because the treatment is really to get away from the exposure, and that's hard to do.
Back at the Cornerstone Clinic, things got so bad they decided they had to close down. They're moving to temporary offices until someone, hopefully, figures out what's going on. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Tomorrow here in Morning Edition, we'll hear about an intensive study that's trying to provide concrete answers to the questions surrounding natural gas production and health.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. In Vermont, the last sap in the spring maple sugaring season isn't good for much. It's too dark and strong to use for commercial maple syrup. But long ago, that late-season sap was used in a potent beer. Steve Zind of Vermont Public Radio reports on efforts to revive this old farm tradition.
In the 1970s, Vermont musician John Castle recorded a locally popular song about sap beer.
Old man with the sugar in through, and what can you be looking for here? Well, son, now we're gonna start brewing sap beer.
Ironically, you would have been hard-pressed to find any sap beer to drink by then. It had taken its place among obsolete farm traditions like milking by hand. In a 1992 interview with the Vermont Folklife Center, the late Edgar Dodge described how sap beer was made on the Vermont farm where he grew up.
Well, I can tell you that you would take the last run of the sugar in operation, you know what I'm talking about? About get down where you can kind of taste the leaves in it, that sort of thing, yeah.
Dodge said that leafy-tasting sap would be boiled down about halfway to syrup. Farmers added hops, yeast, a little sugar, or maybe some raisins, and put it up in a barrel in the cellar. Folklorist Greg Sherrow says sap beer represents a time when farm families got just about everything they needed from their land.
When you ask farmers about farming in that era, they say, well, we lived less on income than lack of expense. So in that context, every possible resource was utilized.
A glass of sap beer was cool relief after a day of hot farm work. As Edgar Dodge remembered, it was brought up out of the cellar just about the time the first hay was cut.
And this would be fit to drink about the first of hand, which would, in those days was 4th of July. You started haying 4th of July.
Any amateur brewer knows there's some guesswork and mystery involved in beer making, and that applied in spades to sap beer. Dodge said you couldn't be sure until you tasted it whether the final product would be drinkable or
junk. Stringy. Nobody could drink it. Cut it off with a pair of shears. That sort of thing.
But when it didn't take a pair of shears to serve it up, what came out of the barrel was a strong brew.
And I don't think the man ever lived could drink 2 8-ounce glasses and walk 10 minutes later. I don't believe so. So that was sap beer. I doubt if there's a barrel of sap beer in the state of Vermont today.
Maybe not when Dodge reminisced about it 20 years ago, but there is a spark of renewed interest in the old refreshment thanks to a couple of Vermont microbreweries.
This is this year's batch of Maple Triple.
This month, Sean Lawson won a silver ribbon at the prestigious World Beer Cup for the sap beer he bottles under his label Lawson's Finest Liquids. Lawson's sap beer is similar to the traditional drink. He ages it in a barrel, and what comes out is high in alcohol content with a strong maple flavor. And it's different every year.
It's a product of the season and the place and the sugar maker and their trees. So every year my batch is a little bit different. That's part of the fun.
Last year, Lawson produced 375 hand-numbered and signed bottles of sap beer. This year's brew is just about ready. For NPR News, I'm Steve Zind in Braintree, Vermont.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, teenagers are getting ready for the summer, but for many of them, it is not all sun and fun. There have been gloomy numbers on the jobs front. So we're going to speak with Hilda Solis. She is the Secretary of Labor, and she'll tell us about how the administration is trying to help more teens get that coveted summer job. But first, we go to the other end of the education spectrum, where you think those job concerns might not be a big issue. Now, we've talked on this program a number of times about how more Americans have been relying on food stamps and unemployment benefits to get by. But you might be surprised to learn, as we were, frankly, about one group that has taken a particularly hard hit. The number of people with PhDs who have had to apply for food stamps or other government assistance like unemployment more than tripled between 2007 and 2010, according to a recent study. The Chronicle of Higher Education recently reported on this, and we wanted to know more, so we've called upon staff reporter Stacy Patton. Also with us is Tony Yang. He received his PhD from the University of California, Riverside, 3 years ago. He's worked off and on as a history lecturer since then, but he has also relied on unemployment benefits and food stamps to get by. I welcome you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Stacy Patton, let me start with you. Why are people with doctorates getting hit so hard?
Well, I guess there's a bit of backstory to answer your question. When I started covering graduate students for the Chronicle, I noticed that there's a lot of overlap between graduate students and adjuncts. These are contingent faculty who are working on contracts. And there's been a major shift in the past 30 years in universities' reliance on contingent faculty. They work part-time. They don't have health benefits. They can be fired or not have their contracts renewed. And so it's a much cheaper way. It's a cost-cutting measure for many universities. But what we continue to do in graduate schools is to encourage people to get master's degrees and PhDs. And the economy has taken such a hit, and so has higher ed has taken such a hit, that they do their work and then come out and not have opportunities for jobs.
Well, let's bring Professor Yang in here, because he's kind of a real-world example of exactly what you're talking about. Professor Yang, you graduated in 2009, and you told Stacy that the first thing you did was file for unemployment, and then for the past 3 years you have worked, but as I understand it, you've never been able to put enough hours together to earn a living wage. Does that about sum it up?
That about sums it up. I think one of the bravest things to do is to try to graduate into the Great Recession. But it's an extremely difficult job market, and you're always constantly hustling to try to get another job or an appointment, and you don't turn them down, even though you probably should. And it's an experience I think a lot of us have shared, those of us who are just coming out onto the job market right now, particularly in higher education.
At your peak, your best year of earnings, do you mind if I ask, what was it?
It was about $32,000.
$32,000 in your best year. Yeah. What about your worst?
$10,000.
10.
Yeah.
So you were making as much as a nanny, basically.
Probably.
A full-time nanny in a, yeah. in an urban area yeah. who's actually making what they're supposed to make, you know. Yeah.
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 You know, Professor V.P. Franklin, he teaches here, and he was teaching at Harvard on one of these renewable contracts years ago. And someone at Harvard, one of the tenured faculty members, told him, well, but you have prestige at teaching at Harvard. His response was, and this is my response to my students, I can't eat prestige.
Mm.
You know, I have the prestige of holding a PhD, but that ain't paying the bills.
We're talking about the rising number of people with advanced degrees who are relying on food stamps and other government assistance to get by. I'm speaking with Tony Yang. He holds a doctorate and has used government benefits to make ends meet. He's currently unemployed. Stacey Patton is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she wrote about this recently. Stacey Patton, you talked about the fact that a number of states have cut their higher education budgets. Are the universities who are using what you call contingent faculty, what I think a lot of people call adjuncts, explicitly as a cost-saving measure, or is there some other cover story, if I can use that phrase?
It depends on who you ask. Certainly, many of the adjuncts would say that it is definitely cost-cutting measure. And so the universities will say, well, our budgets are being cut. We would love to hire more full-time faculty, but we just can't.
Did you have a hard time getting people to talk about this? And I guess the other question I was asking is, did people feel a sense of shame about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would hear graduate students and adjuncts say, well, I make so little bit of money that I actually qualify for food stamps. And so what I did was I got in touch with many organizations such as the New Faculty Majority, Coalition of Academic Workers, and other unions, and talked with their leaders and said, hey, have you heard of people who are actually on government assistance? And they all said yes. The people just kept emailing me, telling me their stories. And then it was a matter of, well, who wants to go on record? And definitely there was a lot of shame. There were a lot of people who wanted to remain anonymous, because you go to graduate school, you get a master's degree, you get a PhD. It's a hard thing to embrace that you're also now on welfare.
Mm-hmm. Professor Yang, do you mind if I ask you, was it a difficult decision for you to decide to go public about your circumstances and to be interviewed and to use your name?
You know, I don't have a problem with that. It might just be my personality. It might have been really the fact that I grew up on food stamps and grew up poor. And I really don't have a problem with it. And I'm not particularly judgmental about it. My parents, on the other hand, are probably a little bit ashamed. I've had my mom tell me on more than one occasion I got the wrong PhD because mine's in history and not in computer science. And because I could somehow be gainfully employed. There's this perception out there that if you have a PhD, you remarkably walk into a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year job. And that's just simply not the case.
Well, let me just focus on something you just talked about here, which is your choice of area of study, your particular academic discipline. There were some comments I noted, Stacey, on the site about this. There were a number of people who offered their own stories, but there were also a lot of people who were very unsympathetic, Professor Yang. They kind of took the same position as your mom, which is, you're smart. Why couldn't you figure out that this was going to be a soft job market? And I apologize if that sounds hurtful, but I did want to ask if that factored into your decision-making at all.
To some extent, it did. I mean, that's why I'm doing economic history and not just, you know, a cultural study of the New Left, not to deride those sort of studies, but it did guide it at some level for that. On the other hand, I think that there's a specific problem with justifying the lack of available full-time teaching positions by sort of saying, well, you know, the market dictates what the market dictates. In a larger political sort of aspect, we teach civics and how the government functions. And when you slash budgets, particularly on the humanities side, you're saying that it's not as important as the engineering disciplines or as in the biochemistry disciplines. And that has very deep effects. And something I tell my students, that the result of some of this horrible political divisiveness or people not understanding political ideology or rhetoric can be directly traced to the lack of underfunding, you know, these basic civics classes.
Stacey Patton, have you found that there are certain disciplines where graduates or people who hold these degrees are more likely to be underemployed than others? Does it tend to be concentrated in the humanities?
From what I'm hearing, yes. I did a short survey that accompanied the piece and took note of the top fields in which graduate degree holders were also food stamp recipients. And they, I believe the top were English and history and communications or something like that. But there were people who were also in biology and in the sciences. I saw maybe two respondents who were in the math.
And finally, you mentioned that there's a vast gap between people who have kind of tenured positions, administrators, and people like Professor Yang who are just starting their careers. Is this seen as a problem in the academy?
Oh, I definitely. I hear all the time from adjunct advocacy groups. I hear it from the adjuncts themselves. I think graduate students are also very anxious. The level of transparency about student outcomes and the availability of jobs and what we're training students to actually do to meet the market demands is starting to be a serious conversation. In terms of people with master's and PhDs on government assistance, I think has come as a shock to many people. I too was shocked by the numbers. It's about 1% of master's degree holders and 1% of PhD degree holders who were on government assistance. So someone might come along and say, oh, that's such a small number. But what's frightening to me is that the numbers more than doubled in a 3-year period. And so one has to wonder, is this trend going to continue to increase? If the government's data has actually captured a full picture of people who have these degrees, who are also in graduate school, and also relying on food stamps or are even eligible for government assistance.
Professor Yang, I have to ask, if you had to do it all over again, do you think you would still pursue your doctorate in this area, in your discipline?
I would. I think it's always worth pursuing intellectual pursuits. It's always worth it to sort of gain a better understanding of the world. And let's face it, you know, if you have a PhD, you're in a subset of the population that has a tremendous amount of skill and determination to actually get that degree. I think at the end of the day, your skills will translate to something. It just might not be in our field. And that's something that's a little bit sad because we're losing a lot of potential and a lot of expertise. But I think it certainly is worth it, at least from an intellectual standpoint, to go ahead and pursue your interest and curiosity and find out what, you know, your subject matter is all about.
Tony Yang has a PhD in history from the University of California, Riverside, and he was kind enough to join us from that campus. Stacey Patton is a staff reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she wrote about the number of people with advanced degrees and graduate students who are relying on government benefits, including food stamps, to make ends meet, and she joined us from Baltimore. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Let's go next to Canada, where real estate prices are soaring. It is now one of the hottest real estate markets in the world. In Canada's largest city, Toronto, home prices went up 10% in March alone. The average price for a house is over $600,000 there. Now, these numbers may be good for sellers, but they have experts worried that the country is in the midst of a housing bubble that is about to burst. Anita Elash has more.
So here's our little house.
40-year-old Jeff Douglas says he knows there are more responsible things to do than take on a mortgage he'll be paying until he turns 70. But he and his wife did it anyway when they bought a 1,300-square-foot duplex in Toronto's West End last month.
Bedrooms are not big.
The house, which he's showing off on a real estate website, is pretty basic. 3 small bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and a partially finished basement. Douglas paid $632,000. That's $76,000 more than the owner was asking for it. But in Toronto's hot real estate market, paying more than the asking price is par for the course. And Douglas thinks he got a bargain.
It was kind of one of the last houses, I think, that we would have had a shot at because the price of the housing goes up every week, you know, as the spring goes on. So we thought this might be our last chance.
Canadian real estate prices did drop during the financial crisis, but they started increasing after a few months and haven't stopped since.
They've set it up so they're taking offers on Tuesday.
Real estate agent Brendan Powell says bidding wars are the norm in many Toronto neighborhoods, even for tiny homes like this 14-foot wide row house.
Last year we were seeing bidding wars that went up to $100,000 over, and that was a really big deal. Now we've actually seen a handful that were more than that, maybe twice that, which is insanity.
Powell's partner, Melanie Pichet, says record low interest rates are fueling the insanity. To keep the economy going, the Bank of Canada has held its prime lending rate at 1%. This winter, banks were offering mortgages for less than 3%, making house prices more affordable for many buyers.
For every extra $50,000, they're only looking at another $200 in mortgage a month, or $210 or $220 at the current rates. And those numbers are manageable for a lot of people. So suddenly you can get the house that you want for an extra $220 a month. Go for it. And now you've just paid $50,000 more than what you were planning on paying.
Powell and Pichet don't believe the Canadian real estate market will crash the way the U.S. market did. Canadian banks have stricter lending rules, and they're not allowed to give mortgages to people with no job or income. But analyst Ben Rabideau is one of many experts who believe house-crazy Canadians are spending themselves into financial disaster.
All of the models scream to me that we're looking at house prices nationally that are overvalued on the order of 30%, at least.
To buy their homes, Canadians have built up more debt than ever. Most can afford it as long as interest rates stay low. But the government has warned rates could start going up soon. When that happens, some studies show that at least 1 million Canadians will be in over their heads. Rabideau predicts people will stop spending, house prices will fall, and the economy will fall into a deep recession. Jeff Douglas is a radio host with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He says he knows there's a risk, but he's willing to live with it.
We made a choice based as much on quality of life as the actual quality of the investment. If it goes down, it goes down. And you sell at a loss. I mean, like people, it happens on the stock market all the time.
Despite his upbeat outlook, Douglas says he's stopped buying coffee at Starbucks and cut back on nachos and beer nights to help pay his mortgage. For NPR News, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
It's called the China effect. Massive demand in China, pushing up prices for commodities from Australian iron ore to Brazilian soybeans. Well, now it's hit a new sector. As NPR's Louisa Lim reports, Chinese buyers are sending prices of racing pigeons sky high.
To the average observer, they look like ordinary pigeons caged into a balcony in a high-rise Beijing apartment. But make no mistake, these cooing birds, according to breeder Yang Shibo, are more like top-of-the-line sports cars.
These are the Ferraris of the bird world. They're the most expensive and the fastest.
The pigeons are being summoned back from their afternoon flight. Pigeons can be lucrative, as the prize money for races is increasing exponentially in China. Yang's best bird, a German pigeon, cost more than $1,000 back in 2001. Its descendants have earned him around $150,000 in prize money. Good pigeons come with family trees going back five generations, like pedigreed racehorses. Indeed, Yang points out, pigeons are, in many ways, the racehorses of China.
Chinese law allows pigeon racing in China. Horse racing is only allowed in Hong Kong, not in mainland China.
Indeed, the highest price ever paid for a pigeon was $328,000, set earlier this year by a Chinese buyer. Chinese make up half the customers at Belgium's premier pigeon house, Pieper. That's up from 18% 6 years ago. The influx of Chinese money means the price of an average pigeon has doubled in a couple of years.
I think the main reason is that they are buying for their status. You are rich, you have a super one, I want to buy a super one too.
That's Luna Lai, Pieper's Greater China manager. She admits the market is overheated.
Somehow the market is really very hot, too hot. But there's still lots of Chinese rich buyer, and they still want to buy. People will say it's like an economy bubble, but I think unless China's economy goes downhill, otherwise I don't think it's a pigeon bubble yet.
Buyers like 40-year-old entrepreneur Xing Wei go to Europe every year to find top-flight, world-class pigeons at astronomical prices, which he asked us not to disclose. Like so many other wealthy Chinese, his fortune is in part from real estate deals. And Chinese real estate money, he says, is driving the pigeon market.
The price of birds imported from Europe to China rises and falls along with the Chinese real estate market. It follows the same trend lines.
Pigeon fanciers flock to his loft in Tangshan, about 100 miles from Beijing. Today, one man has come 700 miles to buy a pigeon for his boss. A single squab, or baby pigeon, bred from Xing Wei's best bird, a Belgian champion racer called Ike, costs a mind-boggling $15,000. Xing Wei's pigeons live in coops on top of his company headquarters. He has three full-time pigeon trainers. Xing Wei's bought 2,000 birds from Europe. He's so determined to raise a flock of super pigeons, sometimes his trainers kill inferior birds in an act of pigeon eugenics. Xing Wei is scathing about China's pigeon races, saying most of the lofts that organize them are dishonest.
It's not corruption, it's just the market is chaotic. The majority of the races, 90%, are not fair. There are lots of things these lofts do, like letting out a bird by itself instead of together with the other birds. Some people use steroids.
Xing Wei's love for pigeons was nurtured by a personal tragedy. He was given his first pigeon aged 5, after a massive earthquake killed 240,000 people in his hometown, Tangshan.
There was devastation everywhere. All the houses were flattened. From then on, I thirsted for and valued life. An elderly neighbor gave me a pigeon. It felt like it was destiny.
That year was the first that pigeon racing was allowed after the Cultural Revolution. It had been forbidden for its capitalist tendencies. In less than 4 decades, Chinese buyers have come from nowhere. Now they set the price for the world's best pigeons. And the anti-China backlash has begun, with European buyers complaining about being priced out of the market. With racing pigeons, as with so many other commodities, China's hold on the market is beginning to unnerve the outside world. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.